Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex. And with me on the other side of this call is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com, to keep up with our most recent episodes. Last week we discussed, I'm blanking out it right
Le
now.
Le Samurai.
I mean, people forgetting about that movie is part of the discussion, so I think it kind of works. Before that, we talked about A Hard Day's Night. Before that was Punch Drunk Love and Andrei Tarkovsky's Stalker. Before that, I've also written something about the difference between the way The Post and Phantom Thread are shot and edited, and how they show generational change. And I'm writing something about the 2007 film The Savages and comparing it to Juno. So that's a very cold take that you can read on our website if you missed the late 2000s in film. So yeah, themacguffinman.com, theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Mm-hmm.
What are we talking about here today?
The 2009 Coen Brothers film, A Serious Man.
Yes. Finally. This has been on the list of movies I want to talk about, I think, since the inception of this podcast.
Yeah, and I mean, one that I don't think either of us were reluctant to do, we having faith in the Coen brothers.
Mm-hmm. I mean, also me having seen this movie like multiple times in theaters, which is a pre-podcast world when this movie
right.
was released.
Yeah. That's right. Mm. Yeah. And now it's time to get to it.
Yes.
And yeah, it's, I mean, we talk about it as a Coen Brothers movie. It's a very Coen Brothers movie.
Yeah. I mean, every Coen Brothers movie, I mean, it's hard to find an example of a Coen Brothers movie that doesn't at some point scream at you, this is a Coen Brothers movie. but even by that standard, this one screams it pretty loud, you know?
Yeah, and it's the follow-up to No Country for Old Men, and
Burn After Reading comes in between.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That is 2008.
I think they had the deal to make Burn After Reading before they won the Oscar, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And so this is kind of them. I mean, not that it ever felt like they were getting a lot of notes beforehand, but this seems to be one that they really got to do what they want and made something, I don't know about personal, we can talk about that, but clearly something that, you know, they've said was an idea that's been kicking around in their heads for a long time, and the movie that looks most like the Coen brothers' childhood. So in that way, it's one that's pretty closely related to them, more so than, you know, just the fact that they made it.
Yeah, absolutely. And anytime a movie comes out that's like just so, I mean, you can do the math. This is around the time the Coen brothers were children. This is takes place in their hometown. You know, it's like, it's not lazy to call this movie personal, but it is, it's lazier than calling Fargo personal, you know, because there's a little bit more legwork you have to do, to sort of find a place in Fargo. But, it's the most obviously personal movie that, the Coen brothers had made. And, but my argument over that term is that I think to dedicate yourself to something for a year or two, or as the Coen brothers got to with Inside Llewyn Davis and Hail Caesar 3 years, like those movies are super personal as well. You know, it's just this is more obviously personal because everybody can see it.
Yeah. And I think that we can make a distinction here between, you know, personal as in it means a lot to you, or you're saying something that you've wanted to say for a long time, mm-hmm. or you know, you're kind of making a statement about something that you've believed for a long time and will believe, and you know, that says more about you and who you've come to be and who you come to think of yourself as, and you know, what you value, whereas this is the personal in the sense of just semi autobiographical, right?
Yes,
like this, this might not be, I mean, I think it is, but you could make this movie without saying a lot about what you believe and just have it look like your childhood, you know, and it not be personally meaningful. But I think this does both. This looks like where they came from, but also says something that I think is something that they kind of hold near and dear.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's not like it's just some sort of like nostalgia fest in any way. Of somebody just being like, well, I'm about 50 now and I just want to look back at a simpler time, you know, like that sort of thing. It's not like the Coen brothers all of a sudden made their version of E.T., you know? So.
Yeah, I mean, listen to our E.T. podcast for our different...
that's a simplistic... I recognize that's a simplistic reading of E.T. as well, but...
Yeah. So what... I mean, this is a weird one. I kind of knew that going into it. It's, you know, as we said, it is kind of about their childhood, but it's also about a lot more than that. And I mean, you just said it's not just a movie that looks back on a simpler time, because this really isn't a, oh, wasn't everything easy and fun when we were 16 movie. And it is, that's what I mean by it's kind of weird. It's really heavy in a way, you know, just there's so many things. There's divorce and death and, you know, police and bribery and violence. But it's also weirdly lighthearted. Like there is something that there is this kind of pervasive sense of the world closing in on this character, but it's also more fun than the way that it would read on paper. Do you get that sense too?
Yes. And that is, I mean, I'm not breaking news to you. That's a very Coen Brothers sort of thing. I mean, I'm also a noted huge fan of Inside Llewyn Davis, which was the film they made after True Grit, which came after this. And that's the first one where it's sort of like they almost lean into the more depressing aspects of their work. It's still a funny movie, but A Serious Man is just like a deeply funny movie to me. And just on the...
Called A Serious Man.
No, I know, exactly. And a very Coen Brothers thing to do, put the name or the word serious in your title and just have it be borderline a laugh a minute. But the way this movie uses sound, and nobody is better at casting tertiary actors than the Coen Brothers. That's something I think we've said on every podcast we've done about a Coen Brothers movie. And yes, this movie might be like their Michael Jordan in 1996 argument, you know, or for that. And I don't even know. There's just something in the way that they are able to direct these actors and use sound design specifically in this movie. I think the sound design is fantastic, even by the standards of cinematic masters like the Coen Brothers. But yeah, it's just the timing and sound, I think, is what makes such a big difference for this movie. And whatever they're able to tell these actors, I don't know if they're like performing it on set and then just saying, do this, or just sort of coaching them in a way that gets these performances out of people every time. Like, it's amazing. And it seems like nobody else has that talent.
Yeah. I mean, we could just go down the list of people we enjoy in this, but I think they could come up more organically. I wanted to know what it was about the sound design that got you here.
I do love this is going to seem like such a minor note, but so frequently in this movie, there are bikes or cars going by in the background of scenes. And the sound is like higher than it should be on those. But I think that's meant to sort of accentuate the idea that there's always something going on that you aren't paying attention to around you. I think that's sort of the idea of Larry getting messages every time he comes into the office, is that like even outside of his life, all these things are going on that he doesn't know about until somebody tells him about them. And I think those bikes and cars that go past, like when the cops come to Larry's door to come try and talk to Arthur while they are sitting Shiva for Sai. That was a hard sentence. There's either a car goes by in the background or bikes go by in the background, and the sound design is loud, louder than you'd think it would be. And that happens probably 10 times throughout the movie and in scenes where those vehicles do not really matter to the story. You also get that instance of Fagel chasing Danny down the street the second time as Larry's having a conversation with his neighbor about the poplar and the property line. And you can hear Fagel coming before anything's on screen, but that's been set up by a previous shot. And also, I think the best example of this is Arthur saying, I'll be out in a minute, repeatedly. And yeah, every time it's funny, partially because Richard Kind has like a very unique sort of funniness about him, but also just in the way it is employed, and it's set up so early on and then comes back from off screen so many times, and at least two or three, and every time it makes me laugh. And those are the elements of sound design that I think it just works so well in this movie. And also Carter Burwell's score, unsurprisingly, is fantastic.
Yeah, so one thing, Richard Kind, like, most recognizable actor in this movie at the time. Which is saying something. I mean, we're closer to Spin City at the time, but still. And then, yeah, we've kind of said that this is a movie, you know, Larry's going through some things, obviously, to put it lightly, and it's sort of a world closing in movie, and I think it kind of achieves that in a different way than other, you know, films do. And I think that pointing out that thing with the cars and the bikes just in the soundtrack, I think, is a great example of that. You know, it's not just the score becoming higher pitched and louder, you know, like there's common ways to achieve that effect, but this is one that is so realistic, right? It's just this diegetic sound, something that's so naturalistic, to just remind us of the fact that, you know, things are happening and things are piling up, and while he's dealing, you know, he's trying to put out one fire, other ones are starting up in other places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And it's not like the sort of like unrelenting intensity of something like Dunkirk, which is a movie that is all about feeling like the world's closing in around you, but it gives off that feeling without doing so obviously, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly.
And that's not me throwing shots at Dunkirk, another movie. Like, that's just as you recorded in early 2018, it's up for multiple Oscars. It's a pretty easy example, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I guess we should talk about Larry, obviously.
Cool.
Michael Stuhlbarg, there you go.
Yep.
I think he's so good in this, and I don't think that's, I mean, other people have pointed this out, so I know that this isn't a controversial stance, but I don't know what this movie looks like without him. You've already mentioned that the Coen brothers are just good at finding people to do things. You mentioned tertiary parts, but I think it's for leading parts as well, and just consistently get good performances out of them. And I don't know. I've been trying to articulate what it is that he does so well in this, and I wanted your opinion on it. But I just think that it's tough to say he carries it, because we like everybody else in this movie too. But I think the performance is so strong, and it's kind of a character we've seen, or a trials movie of someone going through all these things and kind of just domino effects and things piling up that we've kind of seen different versions of, and I think he just manages to succeed in a way that might be different than other people. I just wanted to know what you thought of that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And this is a movie where a character actor plays the lead, you know? And that's sort of where we're at. And I don't even think Boardwalk Empire had started by this point. So Michael Stuhlbarg is, if not totally, I mean, he was unknown to me when I saw this movie in its theatrical release. So I think that's saying something, because I see most things. But he is fantastic. And what you're saying about the Coens being able to cast so well, you know, following up on what I said previously, is that, yes, they are incredible at casting their leads as well. It's just usually they're casting movie stars as leads. And right. But there are examples of them outside of this movie where they don't. I mean, this is the best example, but Oscar Isaac wasn't Oscar Isaac when Inside Llewyn Davis was being made. They discovered Haley Steinfeld, who's unbelievably good in True Grit, which is the movie they made right after this. And yeah, you are right that they not only are able to coach people, they're able to find good people. And there is not, like, literally no performance since this point where people are like, man, Michael Stuhlbarg really brought that movie down. You know, like, he's just so widely regarded as a really, really good character actor and a good supporting actor. And they just sort of were the first on the block to have this record, basically, that is the Michael Stuhlbarg show. And he is fantastic in this movie. And there is something there is something that I can't quite nail down about him that makes him likable, despite the fact that Larry on paper is not a likable character. You know, like there's something. I don't know that he is. And there's something about him that I feel like if you were reading this, he seems so annoying and unlikable just out of pure inaction. And I think from script to screen, there's a lot done between Stuhlbarg and the direction to sort of make him sympathetic that I think if you were left to your own devices, if you were just reading this, I think you would just sort of see him as unlikable, you know?
Yeah, I get that. And I just, it's not that I disagree. I still just think I'm kind of split on that. And that's something I'm still just struggling with, because I think when we watch a character who has so many bad things happen to him, mm-hmm. you kind of just feel sympathetic. Like his wife,
yeah, that's fair.
Seemingly wants to leave him for no reason. You know, he seems very taken aback by it. And I mean, where do you start? Like the bribery, him seeing a lawyer die in front of him.
Yeah. Being in a terrible automobile accident.
Yeah. Being, his kids, let's just say, seem underappreciative of him as a father.
Yeah.
So in that way, I think that you kind of are on his side, just watching him go through all these things. And he's not really mean to anybody in this movie. And then... I think you're right. I think when you said that he, you know, just through his inaction, you know, the way that he could do more to help a situation or help maybe others around him as well. And he has this line that he says a few different times. I mean, at least twice, where he says, I didn't do anything. He says that, I think in regards to his divorce.
Correct.
You know, and... what's the other one?
There are two other ones when he's talking to Dick Dutton of the Columbia Record Company, talking about how he didn't order Santana Abraxas, he didn't listen to Santana Abraxas, he didn't right. do anything, and then and also then towards Oscar. The end.
Well, and whoever was on the tenure committee when he's yeah. asking him what else he's published or anything, he says, I didn't do anything,
yep.
or I haven't done anything. And so it's the same line, but it's got this wide range of different meanings. You know, he says, I haven't done anything in regards to his marriage. You know, I haven't, you know, I'm not cheating on you. I don't hit you. You know, I haven't done anything wrong. So why would you want to divorce me? And in regards to his job, you know, I haven't done anything. I haven't really achieved much with my position thus far. Why would you, like, maybe I won't get promoted. You know, I haven't published anything else. I haven't done anything, but they're the bare minimum. And so when you bring up disliking him for inaction, I just think that, yeah, to repeat this line about his inaction, but with different meanings to it. Does that change your stance on him being sort of this inactive character that isn't worthy of sympathy?
I suppose dislike is slightly different from what I kind of am trying to communicate, which is more frustrating, I guess.
Right.
Whereas, yeah. you know, I just sort of, I suppose I feel an indifference toward him as a human being and find him frustrating as a character. You know what I mean? And just specifically because of that inaction, not like I'm the most active human being in my own life, but like there is something more to that when you're watching a film and seeing somebody just repeatedly, I don't know, it's tricky. But yeah, as you're saying about the line, I haven't done anything, and in its various iterations, I don't know. I don't even know. Cause I mean, that's all building up to him finally sort of taking that cash out of the envelope. You know, that's the rare moment of action for Mr. Larry Gopnik. And that sort of is the end of the movie. So I guess I don't have any sort of strong take about it that's not tied directly to the very end of this movie. I just sort of find Larry kind of frustrating. But the thing that I need to explain that really frames where I'm coming from with Larry is that this whole movie is built around him. You know, we've got the prologue that he does not appear in. And we have basically, to my recollection, every scene for the rest of the movie, with the exception of when Danny goes to speak to Marshak right after the bar mitzvah, his bar mitzvah. Larry is either in every scene or is in his own moment intercut with the scene. You know, there's the doctor's exam while Danny's in the classroom. At the very beginning, the sigh and Larry car crashes into Cut. Like those types of sequences happen a few times. But with the exception of Danny going to see Marshak, Larry's in every scene of the movie. So I like, and unsurprisingly, we're supposed to come at this movie from his perspective. And I think there's a really key scene late in the movie where Arthur is talking to Larry, and it's when they're sitting at the pool, and Arthur's saying, look what he's given you. And Larry says, I don't have anything. And Arthur lists off all of these things that he does have, you know, and specifically you have a family. And I sort of start to view it from after that conversation, I view it as like a movie from Larry's perspective. And this movie is so in Larry's head that it sort of reframes the projection of these characters. Like these kids are annoying because Larry is annoyed by his kids. And it's just sort of like, he feels like the world is closing in on him. So everything around him is exaggerated. And there's this very sort of exaggerated feel to the movie. And I think part of the unlikability for me comes from, I suppose, my own projection on the meaning of this movie, in that it feels so closely tied to Larry's own perspective that he's seeing all of these things, these outside things, as annoyances when they could just be positive things that if he looked at them differently, you know, it's the look at the parking lot sort of thing. Look at this thing you've seen a million yeah. times, but look at it with fresh eyes and it looks totally different, which is a scene that's played comedically, but is an idea that I can support. So I don't know. I suppose that's a long way of saying I have complicated feelings towards Larry Gopnik.
Yeah, I can see that. Like when he comes home and his kids are complaining right away, like no one around him seems to be doing their own thing for a little bit. It's all interactions with him I kind of said this was, been speaking about sound design, this is a pretty naturalistic kind of movie. You know, mm-hmm. there's not
Godzilla roars or anything.
Yeah, there's just not big effects or anything, other than I guess the tornado near the end. Mm-hmm. And you know, it just seems like a normal guy's kind of, you know, life kind of falling apart, but in a sense that doesn't seem so incredible sometimes. But yeah, it's called A Serious Man. We can kind of guess that might be him, and it's, you know, as you said, it's so tied in with his story, but so like over tied in with him, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's just no way that his world is this centered on him. Like it does seem like such a subjective experience of someone's life and not following someone through the world while everybody interacts with everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I will say, I like, as I was talking about my sort of reading on that, that's the type of reading that comes from having seen a movie 8 times, which is probably about where I'm at this point. I don't think that Coen's necessarily intended that to sort of be the feeling of the movie, but I also sort of feel like they are smart enough to know that they make movies that allow for all sorts of projections to be on them, and they never talk about their movies to allow these projections to fester in people like myself's brain. Because that does seem like a theory that I would say if somebody else was saying, I'm like, you're reaching a little bit, but but I don't know. That's something I like about these types of movies, is that the Coen brothers are so obviously skilled at the way they are able to put together this movie, the way that it can be funny, and you know, just all the technical aspects that go into the filmmaking and the performative aspects from the cast, that it just sort of, you trust them because you have so many examples of them being obviously fantastic and obvious masters of this medium, that you're like, okay, I assume that they got everything right so that I can put all of my thoughts into whatever I want, you know?
Yeah. And that's something that I think you find in a lot of reviews. Like after I saw this, I just read a lot of different reviews on it, and some of them would be contemporary and coming off, you know, a recent Oscar win, and I mean, I know Burn After Reading was in the middle there, but, and they're just, even before No Country for Old Men, they're the Coen brothers, right? I mean, we trust them before they won an Oscar.
Yeah, but they were leading into No Country for Old Men, and I think, because I think it's an important moment in Coen brothers' history, is to, like, the 2000s didn't go so well for the Coen brothers up until No Country for Old Men. You know, like, they were really in a down period. If you look at their career, post Big Lebowski, and The Man Who Wasn't There is kind of an outlier because that's just a movie that not a lot of people saw, so people kind of forget about it. But Oh Brother was well received, but I think the recognition of that movie has really faded, and it is certainly in my eyes one of the lesser Coens. So but after that you're looking at The Lady Killers, Intolerable Cruelty, and these are just two movies that nobody liked, and that's before No Country for Old Men, you know. So so they were regarded as fantastic auteurs, but it is worth noting that there was a period of about 5 years where people were like, maybe they don't have it anymore.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And just reading those reviews, there was sort of that sense of, I don't know exactly what they're trying to say here. It feels like they've intentionally left things in a way that I can inject some of my own ideas into this. You know, the prologue scene, you know, doesn't really connect with anything. You can take some themes from it and definitely connect that with the rest of the movie. But there isn't that direct connection. We kind of have a cliffhanger at the end of that and a cliffhanger at the end of the movie, mm-hmm. or maybe not a cliffhanger, but a big question mark that, you know, something's going to happen here. And there is just this sense of, I don't know exactly what to take from this, but these guys really know how to frame a shot, and these performances are great. And so, you know, give some credit to the actors and cinematographers and set design and all that. But I just, in reading reviews, I just kept coming across this notion of, there's a lot for you to bring to the table with this one, but only because they've set the table so well that, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot to look at, and there's a lot to keep you entertained. And we might all have differing opinions on what to take from this, but there is something there to be taken.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And things that in the script that sort of make you think about these things, you know, sort of recognize the professionalism of what's being done, and so that there must be meaning behind some of these things, are just the way they even something as simple as how they set up jokes. Like, they've got as we were talking about, Be Out in a Minute is probably the most repeated laugh in this movie, but there's a handful of times where characters say something funny that then gets said again. Larry saying, I mean, this is sort of a mild sort of humor, but Larry saying, we're sitting Shiva here a couple times is funny both times. Esther is barely cold is probably my favorite, because when Stuhlbarg says it the first time, it's funny on its own, and then when Adam Arkin says it later on, the way he says it is so funny. And it's just such like a weird phrase to have said by different characters at totally yeah. different times. And it's just all those little things that anytime a filmmaker does something like that, that's sort of almost like a callback, be it a visual. Again, we mentioned Fagel chasing Danny, or I forget the daughter's name, but her knocking on the bathroom door.
Sarah.
These are things that, even if you don't necessarily recognize what's happening as they're happening, you know, that you sort of feel it. You're like, there's something in you. I mean, this isn't a super long movie. You barely have time to forget things. The one thing you do forget, I think, is somehow the most amazing thing the Coens do in this movie. But we'll get to that. But even if you aren't like thinking about it, because Fagel chasing Danny isn't the most important thing in the world, but when it happens the second time, you recall that it happened the first time, you know? And there are so many examples of that through this movie, that the professionalism of it just oozes through the film. And I think the key example that I alluded to is at the end of the movie, when the doctor calls, you have had just enough time to forget that the beginning of this movie in Larry's story is him at the doctor. And I think that's like, there's something about the way the Coens are able to pull that off that is just so deeply satisfying to me, because it's our introduction to the character. Again, I've seen this movie like 8 to 10 times. Like, every time I watch it, when there's been, you know, a year or whatever in between, I always forget he was at the doctor at the beginning of the movie, and it just becomes such a key point. And it makes the ending hit so much harder. And it's just, that's just like directing. Perfect directing in a nutshell is that you know exactly how much time your audience needs to forget about something, but still remember it in the deep recesses of their brain.
Yeah.
at a point in the movie when there's literally like 30 seconds left and they have to they have to recall it immediately, otherwise the ending of the movie doesn't work. Yeah.
Some of the comedic stuff you're mentioning, I'll say that I think if this is a movie that in the end you were kind of anything from you know, you felt it was kind of middling to you just didn't like it.
Yep.
I still think a lot of that funny stuff lands. Like if you don't buy into this, it that's okay. That stuff will still is just too funny. Mm-hmm. But you know, so to somebody like that, someone who, you know, has a middling to less opinion of it, like do you think this makes a complete film? Like if someone said that, yeah, I just didn't know what was happening, it just kind of seemed thrown together. Do you get that sense at all, or is that just you think that they might be missing the point, or do you think that there's something missing here that could make it more of a complete vision, or how do you feel about that?
There is nothing missing from this film. This film is borderline perfect.
Best picture nominee.
Must be doing something right. So that's a hard conversation to, or a hard question to answer, specifically because every person that I know that, I mean, this movie came out at a time when I went to the movies with a lot of people and had a high success rate of being able to talk people into going to see movies that I liked with me. So I probably saw this movie with about 8 different people over the course of various screenings, and not 8 separate screenings, you know, there's like 5 at one screening or whatever. I remember everybody liking it, even people that didn't have a strong reading on the ending. And I don't remember how I felt about this movie the first time I saw it. I weirdly cannot remember where I saw it for the first time, which it, is something I have a really strong memory for typically. And I think that sort of speaks very strongly to the movie somehow, and like its sense of mystery. yeah. I know I loved it. I don't think I would have had, just knowing who I was at the time in 2009, I certainly wouldn't have had a strong reading on anything. I know when a strong reading on this movie started to build in my head, but it was a couple of years later. So I think even I was just watching it as somebody who was just incredibly entertained and loved the idea of there being questions at the end. And the more I've watched this movie, the more I've gotten out of it. And but to go back to the theoretical person who just didn't like this movie, I haven't had actual conversations with that person. So like, I feel, I don't know. I don't know what I would say, you know?
Okay. Yeah. And so do you have a stronger take on the ending now then?
Well, okay. So I think, no, my answer is no. The short answer is no, because okay. I don't think the Coens make movies that give you strong endings, like strong, like points with exclamation marks on them. And I think they make deceptively complicated movies. And usually it ends up being something about something that's more simple than all the running around sort of makes you feel like it would be. So say Fargo, one of their most famous movies, if not their most famous movie, right? It's got that line towards the end where Marge, Frances McDormand's character, says something along the lines of, it's a beautiful day, you know? And it's just sort of about accepting this world for what it is, right? And just sort of looking at it, choosing to be a positive person and looking at it that way. I kind of view Larry as somebody who is the anti-Marge, in that he chooses to look at the world as like a terrible place, you know? And of course these are not positive things that are happening to Larry all throughout the movie, but there is a sense of just sort of being in his own head over and over again that seems to at least mentally serve to Larry's detriment. And I think there are like two key quotes that are used in this movie that sort of sum it up. And I mean, these are obvious quotes to use because one book ends the movie and the other is the very beginning of the movie. But the Jefferson Airplane line, when the truth is found to be lies, that's the first thing, you know, you hear in the Jefferson Airplane song in the opening sequence with Danny. And it's just sort of about how you react to the idea of figuring out the world is outside of your own control, and how things just sort of happen around you, whether or not you... you know, no matter what you do or what you don't do, things will happen. And that's a very Coen-y sort of thing to do, is just sort of give in to the futility of human existence and just sort of like try and ride it out. And the very first quote from a medieval French rabbi after 10 seconds of Wikipedia research that I did named Rashi is, "Receive with simplicity everything that happens to you." And that sort of just augments the idea that you just have to kind of accept that this is life and you don't really have control over it, and getting all up in arms about it is almost counterproductive to your own well-being, you know? And I know that's a simplistic reading, and my readings on Coen brother movies are typically like simplistic in that way. But I think the way that they built this movie, even more than some of their others, that have sort of similar themes, is that they want to just build this maze. They want to build that Mentaculous book, you know, where it's just like scribble, 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 scribble. And it's just like, it's appealing to watch. But the idea at the core is very simple. And the more thought you want to put into it, you can do so. But there is also just something very, very simple at the core of it, you know? And it's just sort of that Larry's... the type of person Larry is making his life worse, you know, even among all these like legitimately bad things that are happening. You know?
Yeah. And that was connecting to something like kind of how we started this too. And I was reading the Wikipedia page while doing research for this movie, just kind of reading the synopsis, just kind of refresh my memory. And there's a line in the Wikipedia synopsis that says Larry turns to his Jewish faith for consolation, which I mean, I think is this entire movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to go hand in hand with what you were saying, I think that it kind of seems a bit of an indictment on religion, or, I mean, Judaism specifically, which has been weirdly absent from our discussion so far, considering how present it is throughout this movie.
Yeah. I mean, that part of that is a limited knowledge on our part of Judaism. You know?
True. I'll own up to that. But I just watching it, I was kind of looking at it as, you know, maybe the way that Larry is so disappointed by when, you know, he looks for consolation and is never even being able to speak to the Marshak and getting the junior rabbi and just him struggling to get that appointment and things like that. And his, you know, his meeting with the junior rabbi being seemingly very, very disappointing to him.
And a rabbi so junior he doesn't even recognize what the concept of a get is, even though he's a rabbi, you know.
Yeah. And you know, it just seemed like, oh, maybe they're trying to say that this religion altogether isn't maybe that useful in the modern world anymore or something. And then it just seemed that, you know, by the end, Danny has this connection with the Marshak, and he says something about the music, and he seems to really take something from it so recently after being bar mitzvah, that it really seems to have this value. And I was thinking about this just while you were talking there, that kind of Larry doesn't seem to look at it that way. He kind of has this selfish take on it, and that he wants an answer to something right away. And when he speaks to other people, they kind of say, yeah, this is what happened to someone else. This is what I told him. Like Larry kind of comes with a very direct question that he wants a direct answer to. And his faith isn't able to provide that. But in the end, there was this value to it, to Danny, and that religion doesn't function to him in this very empirical, straightforward way. And you know, he's a physics professor. You know, he's more into rationalism and empiricism and science, and that's just not what religion is. And I think he's kind of taking this view of wanting this direct answer right away, and frustrated with the lack of that sort of response that he's getting. But by the end, we kind of see that there is value in it. It's just kind of in a different way, and you take a step back, and that it has provided the sense of community and, you know, gives something to Danny that's, you know, he really seems to value in kind of a way that he has a distance from it, but he does see that it is meaningful when he gets to the Marshak, who, you know, really, I think, stands in for sort of the older, very established religion, mm-hmm. not just kind of a vague spirituality. And yeah, just after all this time, I think I kind of get left with the sense that this isn't an anti-religion or an anti-Judaism thing. It's more anti-Larry's way of handling himself and his connection with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do want to go back to the Danny talking to Marshak later, but just for the Larry sort of side of things, like, I mean, you see a perfect example of that in the story of the Goy's teeth, and the way that Sussman becomes obsessed with something and trying to get answers from something, and Knockner is the second level rabbi, and he finishes his story and Larry's like, wait, what happened? Like, that's not enough of an answer, you know? Like,
exactly.
That's not the end of the story. And the rabbi says something along the lines of, I think I wrote this down quickly, so it's probably not the whole line, but the teeth, we don't know. Sign from Hashem, we don't know. Helping others couldn't hurt. And like, Sussman takes that as like, that's fine, that's enough. And he continues with an epilogue to the story, and that Sussman keeps checking teeth for a while, and then eventually he just sort of lets it go and he just goes back to living his life. And what do we see shots of Sussman doing? Enjoying life, which we almost never see Larry doing. And it's just sort of, again, that what you're saying mixed with what I'm saying, and just the idea of it's his approach to religion that is the problem, more so than religion itself, and his approach to
everything
that is a problem. Also, and something that leads into that is the woman with the leg braces on the beach hangout that's talking about, we've got this well of tradition, stories handed down from people who have been through it before. You know, that's what leads up to the conversation with Knockner. And that's basically, I think, how religion is projected in a nutshell in this movie. And then it's just for Larry to either take it or not. And pretty much every time the answer is not.
So I
want to know your reading on the Danny Marshak conversation again, because you seem to have a more positive outlook on it than I do.
Well, I mean, I think Marshak, as I said, kind of represents this much older, more traditional. I mean, it's with this very old ceremony, rite of passage of bar mitzvah. Blanket apology if I accidentally misspeak about any of this stuff. As we said, we just don't know that much.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, you know, we get this, Danny's, you know, the youngest character, I guess, that we really know. And I mean, maybe some of his very profane friends on the bus are younger, but you know, they all seem to
they're
be the
all
same
fuckers
age.
Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. But he's the youngest one that we kind of deal with. And so I think of him as the future, and I think of Larry as kind of the present and the one we focus on the most. And then Marshak, as, you know, tradition and establishment. And they just seem out of sync. And I just find that when they have this connection, you know, maybe a small one, but this connection over lyrics and something that seemingly is very meaningful to Danny, that,
and specifically lyrics from a song that we are led to believe Danny likes, in that he's listening to it multiple times in this movie.
That's what I mean, but that's definitely worth mentioning. It just bridges that gap that I was talking about, that there still is value to this religion and this community, to these people, and that it's Larry's flaws, personality, mishandling, idiosyncrasies that don't allow him to gain what is positive about it, but that it's not that these are outdated ideas. It's just a personal thing that Larry's not doing well, but Danny seemingly has the potential for in the future to handle and to do well.
Okay.
What's your kind of pessimistic look at it?
I mean, it's not necessarily pessimistic in that I just sort of think that this is, again, tied to my sort of, this movie all comes from Larry's perspective, and this is the scene where we're in Danny's perspective, the one scene in the movie where we're not in Larry's perspective or tied to it, again, outside of the prologue. Danny's really baked, and I sort of, like, I know they're not doing the sort of stoned vignetting that they do in the shots of characters that are like really high and happened in the bar mitzvah just before it. But I sort of think that like the way that scene plays out like a 13-year-old is so high, and that is how he remembers it, only because he was so high that he couldn't even deal with the situation, and that's just how he remembers it. So I get what you're saying, and I see it 100%. I just don't think Danny is in a mind state to sort of even accept something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah, it you saw that was kind of the seed of this movie too, eh?
That they thought of the idea of somebody being very stoned for their bar mitzvah, and that's the and they built the movie around it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that is cool. And I think it is worth noting that again, as a movie that's so closely tied to Larry's perspective, the scene that Larry's not involved in is a scene, you know, it's a rite of passage for Danny, in that it's yours and it's nobody else's. And even for a movie that's so about Larry, this is the one thing that they let Danny have on his own, you know?
Yeah.
Or
yeah,
let any character have on their own. And I think maybe that sort of ties into what you're saying, in that your connection to religion is so personal and so tuned to who you are as a human being that
even your dad can screw it up.
Yeah, exactly. Even not even your Debbie Downer dad can get in there. You know?
Who needs to be the star of everything?
Yeah. Well,
including the movie.
Yeah, he has to be a serious man, even though it's already been decreed that Psy is a serious man.
I mean, big shout out to Fred Melamed in this movie, who is someone who I already liked, but just goes up a couple more notches in my books as a result of this film.
Yeah, nobody's ever sad to see Fred Melamed in a movie, and whether or not you know who he is, like, I didn't know who he was until this movie. This is the first movie I remember seeing him in, and but man, he's fantastic in this movie, you know? And he's good at everything else.
Yeah, and speaking in so him as sort of a character actor in this movie, as led by a character actor who was pretty unknown by this point. Mm-hmm. I think that's another kind of point for this being sort of a personal movie, in that it doesn't come with all these preconceived notions about who these actors are and other characters that they've played.
Yeah, where it's, again, to bring up Dunkirk, in that the Coens were the star of this movie, just like Christopher Nolan was for Dunkirk. You know, it's sort of like all the famous people are out of the way, and that sort of amplifies elements of the director's influence on the movie too.
Right, you know? And Fred Melamed is Harry Styles. And
yes, of course. So,
in a, again, sort of a bigger, more abstract perspective on it, in the Coen brothers' filmography, I mean, this does, as you said, does what Coen brothers movies do, and reminds you that it is a Coen brothers movie. And we have, you know, they've done the dream sequences thing in other movies, like Barton Fink and Man Who Wasn't There. And I still think there's just a lot of Fargo in this movie, right? Am I alone in that?
Yes. No, sorry, you're not alone. Okay. I agree with you that there is a lot of Fargo in this movie. I think they are drastically different movies, about drastically different perspectives, but are not fundamentally different movies as far as like what I get out of them. Yeah.
Okay, and so what's the big similarity here in, you know, movies that if you were to read the plots, don't seem like the same movie at all?
Well, I think it's the Larry Marge dynamic, and I think it kind of plays out in the way like the Larry and his wife, whose name I'm forgetting, but in fairness, I'll forget Marge's husband's name too.
The Zodiac.
Hey, if he was the Zodiac, he's not the Zodiac, and if he was, he wouldn't tell you. And just the way that even in the prologue, you know, we have the man and the woman that are just so clearly the husband and wife that are so clearly representing different sides of an argument, in that the wife believes in a more spiritual sort of side of things, whereas the husband says specifically, "I'm a rational man," or something like that.
She really doubles down on her belief that
She's gonna confidently murder somebody. That's how maybe she's a murderer. I don't know. We don't get a lot of establishment. Maybe she's a serial murderer. But anyway, just the idea of spiritual versus rational. And you see that a lot with Larry and his wife as well. You know, like Larry's wife is very big on the spiritual side of things and, you know, making sure that part of this is Cy, but she's on board with it clearly in that there's a get involved in their divorce. And I sort of view Larry and Marge as like Coen brother leads that are just sort of view life in totally different ways. Like Marge is surrounded by all these horrible things, people being put in wood chippers, you know, like, and she still is able to view life in a positive way. You know, she's still sort of able to give her speech where she says, just look around, it's a beautiful day, as she's driving Peter Stormare to the police station. And Larry just does not have that capability. And he's not even able to see the things that he has in his own life that are positive things. You know, he's not able to receive with simplicity everything that happens around him. You know, he just doesn't have that makeup. And I think the meaning of the movie is that Marge is able to survive those things because of her outlook on life. And Larry's life is so much more difficult because of his. You know, that's how I see these movies as similar.
Yeah, and I think that with Larry, I see a lot of, I mean, one scene in particular, but I think it kind of pervades the film, is he's Jerry Lundegaard. He's the William H. Macy character from Fargo. Exactly. You know, we see that in the Columbia Records scene over the phone. I mean, they even have the same guy on the other end of the phone playing that character, is how similar those moments are. Mm-hmm. And Marge and Jerry don't, I mean, they're on other sides of the law. They don't really play direct, you know, foils to each other in Fargo. You know, they're at odds, but it's not really a kind of a one-to-one relationship that they have. Mm-hmm. But Marge is this very straightforward, honest, good person, and Jerry is just deceptive and, you know, not even upfront about the crimes that he's committing or the bad things that he's doing. And he's just very shady in the way that he speaks to people. And so in that way that they're kind of foils to each other. And, you know, that's just what Larry is here. He's just out of touch or kind of refuses to be in touch with reality in a certain way, I feel.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I see that for sure.
Yeah.
And as long as we're comparing this to other Coen brothers movies, I mentioned this on the podcast we did about that movie, but I see A Serious Man and Hail Caesar basically as movies that hold hands. You know, like, they're so similar to me.
Okay.
In a deeply positive way. they're just so similar in that, like, they're different worlds, and Josh Brolin's character, or Eddie Mannix, has a different sort of makeup than Larry does, of course. Because I can't imagine Josh Brolin really playing this sort of Larry Gopnik type of character. Although we get maybe a touch of it as Bigfoot. But what were you saying?
Josh Brolin has too much jawline to be a Larry Gopnik.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they don't really share the same makeup, but just sort of the things that I really appreciate about A Serious Man in the way that there is this world bubbling around this main character, and this main character feels like they're running out of control, or they don't have control of their own life. And the main lesson of the idea is to sort of be, or of the movie is to sort of try to let go, and whether or not you can is still a question. But it's I think the main theme of both movies is to let go a little bit more than you have. So yeah, I've always seen those two movies as very closely linked in my head.
Yeah, no, yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So I don't know. I feel like there's so much about this movie that I love. Just the phrase whoopsie doopsie needs to be mentioned. Like, it's so good. But I think things that we've kind of been talking about without giving specific examples are the little small things that the Coen brothers do that sort of sort of pump up the feeling of professionalism about them, in that they're making a movie that you might not have a clear answer coming out of it, but you just trust that there is an idea behind there, you know? And it's just some things that happen throughout this movie. We talked about the Mentaculous, is just the idea of there being something that you can't know, and something that you can never conquer. Arthur is just what basically looks like scribbles in this book. And it's just this ongoing math problem, but it's so complicated. It just looks like nonsense. And you can tell that nobody's ever really going to solve it. It just like he's never going to entirely drain whatever it is in the back of his neck. That's just something that's just going to keep filling up. It's just a thing that's not going to go away. And what I was talking about with the background vehicles and Larry's problem with the property line and that Edward. Lawyer dying just before, like, they're like, oh, he's totally figured it out. He's a master of this stuff. Not to mention the mild interplay between those two lawyers, which is hilarious in the way that Arkin's character clearly is jealous of him. But, you know, he dies right before he can tell anybody about how to solve the property line issue. And even at the very beginning, with the doctor smoking, you know, it's like even the most informed about human health at this point, we're still in the dark about smoking killing you, you know. And I think that there's a consistent feeling of the idea that there's always something out there that you can't know the answer to. And that's so runs so consistently throughout the movie. And it's so important to the movie, and just the way that these things are tied together, even within Larry's own perspective, and the way that some scenes cut together, you know, him and Larry and Si in the car crash, even that Larry's going to work and Si's going golfing, just like different aspects of life that they're experiencing. The funeral and the bar mitzvah, the camera setups are very similar in those. The son listening to music in class in the first scene, Danny listening to music in the first scene in class, while Larry's having his ear examined in the doctor's office. Just all of these little things that sort of tie together and just make a movie that clearly has no real answer to give you other than what you want to put into it. And the ending of the movie is basically the question: does Larry get that call from the doctor because he accepted a bribe, or would that have happened regardless? You know, and it all builds up to just like one phone call and one tornado, and it's just absolutely fantastic. And the fact that the Coen brothers have made a movie as good as Fargo, and it's probably like my fifth favorite movie they've made, is absolutely bananas. You know, like that's a level of talent that is just so borderline underappreciated, even though they're highly regarded filmmakers.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. It's this weird world that they live in where everybody knows that they're talented, but somehow when they don't have a movie currently out, people forget. And every time I watch a Coen Brothers movie, I'm just marveled, especially like post No Country and afterwards, with the exception of Burn After Reading and True Grit. I think they've done some of their best work late in their career. And I just think they're amazing, you know. And this is an absolute perfect example of everything that's good about the Coen Brothers and everything that's kind of hard to describe about the Coen Brothers.
Yeah, and I, as the end sort of comes together, which is odd to say about a movie that's about everything unraveling. Mm-hmm. When, yeah, he's just receiving that phone call and there's finally a really substantial score, and I think the music there is great. And you know, it's kind of been fun and funny and just kind of bouncing around, and it's got this hectic feeling and you're trying to keep up with everything. And then I find that at the end, I think the music does a lot for it too, as I said, but it just finally is kind of coalesced into this big emotional moment. And mm-hmm. it takes all of that, all those stepping stones to get there, to have been laid really well by confident filmmakers. And then it brings us to that point. And I don't know, I just find that end really escalates emotionally. And for them to do that after, you know, what I said is kind of this weird, lighthearted, playful thing about some very sad, serious stuff, I think is an impressive turn.
Yeah, exactly. And that they're doing that all in sort of a mirror sequence of the first scene post credits with the with Larry at the doctor's office and Danny in class, like both of those characters are getting the finish to that scene from the very beginning. Larry's getting the end of his doctor's appointment and that he's getting the follow-up about the x-rays, and Danny is still trying to get Fagel his $20. And I just think that sort of circularity is just so impressive and so difficult to do and so impossible to keep us so entertained in the middle of those sequences, that it's just like, again, we're not saying anything new. Joel and Ethan Coen know how to make movies, but I think that's like just the thing I love the most about movies is just something about it. There's something so deeply cinematic about this movie. It's so different on screen than it is on the page. And they're obviously fantastic writers, but they're just so, so perfect at directing their already very good writing that it elevates it to another level. And they're the Coen brothers for a reason. Yeah,
absolutely.
So thank you for listening to our very Coen-y congratulatory podcast. Be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about something else.